friends, it's always a pleasure to come back to Champaign and meet with this particular group, the faculty group, which I've had the privilege to meet before. In fact, I think I've been back so many times that I sometimes feel a little bit embarrassed. My subject is going to run out before very long. But today you have asked me to speak on this topic of communism, its appeal and its menace. I want to present these two sides, side by side, because I think too many of us today perhaps sense the menace and forget the appeal communism has to people. And because we do that, we are liable to underestimate the strength that's opposed to our side of life. And when you underestimate a cause of that type, we sometimes run into disasters ourselves. And so I like to present these two sides so that we can see the thing, both in its strength as it appeals to people, and the threat that it poses to life on the way we believe in life. Now, on the side of appeal, you readily see that a movement, any movement, which has spread as it has in such a large part of the world, is bound to have some appeal, isn't it? It couldn't have just happened haphazardly. And what is the appeal of communism? I'm going to mention just two cases, actual cases, that I've learned myself through actual contact. One way back in about 1923, and the other about 1939. The first case is of a man who became a communist. And why? This first man I'm going to speak about happened to be the pastor, the rector of my own local church in Shanghai, St. Peter's Church. He was a schoolmate of mine in St. John's University. After he finished his science and arts, he took up theology and was ordained minister and became rector of my local church in Shanghai. And so for a few years, we worked together. I was on the vestry of the church, and he was, of course, our minister. Then suddenly, around about 1923, he disappeared. Just clear, dropped off the sight altogether. And nobody knew what had happened to him. His family didn't know what had happened to him. We didn't know in the church what had happened to him. But there soon came rumors. The first kind of rumors were these, that he had been killed, or had been kidnapped, or done away with, or so on and so on. But then those rumors gave place to another kind. People began to say, oh, we've seen this man here and there in Shanghai, that he had become a communist. But nobody knew for sure what really has happened. Until one day I happened to run into him on the streets of Shanghai. I could hardly recognize him, but I did, because his face had become rather coarse and black. His hands were rough with work, and he was dressed not in the way I would be dressed ordinarily, but in the short garments of a working man. This man called Pu Huaren. So I buttonholed him and wanted to know what had happened, why he had dropped out like this. Well, you can understand he wasn't willing to talk at first. But when he saw that he couldn't get away from me, then he had to do something to meet my wishes. So we adjourned to a place, and I got from him, as far as he was willing to tell, his reasons why he had become a communist. He said, you know that as your pastor, we worked together a few years, and you know my interest in the welfare and life of the workers of Shanghai. Shanghai, as you know, is a big industrial town with hundreds and thousands of workers. But in the 1920s, the working man in my country has very little protection for himself. He is the entirely subject, almost, to exploitation of any kind. He had no unions very much to protect him, earned the pittance of a wage, no provisions for safety or sickness or anything of that type. And so anybody with a conscience in those days, and particularly a Christian minister, when he sees hundreds of thousands of people like that making up the industrial areas of Shanghai, well, he couldn't just let that thing go by and do nothing about it. And so he got us in the church to raise money and give time to go into the industrial areas with little clinics here and a little school for the children, all kinds of things. to help these people so that they would have a little better way to live. Then, he said, after 2 or 3 years in that kind of work, he said, I began to realize that I'm doing a very, very superficial thing. Because after all, I'm playing the part of a nurse, binding up the wounds that this industrial system had caused in lives of people. I'm not doing anything to stop the system that creates those wounds. I'm merely patching it up, binding it up, making it a little more comfortable for the victims. And he said, how long am I going to do just that? And so he said, I awoke to the fact that I have to do something more fundamental than that. Perhaps change my role from a nurse to a surgeon and actually wield a knife, cut out the sore altogether, and then hope that new flesh would grow round that wound. But he said, if I should do that in the church, you know that someday you will kick me out. And so he said, I have anticipated your action and left the church. Become a factory hand and a communist. And from within them, try to work for a system that would not continue endlessly, decade after decade, turning out these industrial casualties that break people's lives. Now here's a man who has nothing to gain as far as becoming communist is concerned, who has gone over because of his convictions, right or wrong. And he risked his life, and once he was caught by the government, but fortunately his sentence was commuted from death to correctional confinement by General Jiang, so he later escaped with his life. And today is one of the men very high in the Central Council of the Communist Group. Now there you have a man who sees and has a conscience on the life of the underprivileged person, particularly in the industrial area, who, before he became a communist, had already his feeling, desire to work for that kind of people. And when he saw that we were not ready to really tackle the causes of this thing, then he saw in the communist movement a greater promise of really doing something fundamental to change the system that will make the life of these people a better way of life. And so today in communist society, the two upper stratas of society are these. First is nong, gong, bing, the farmer, the farm worker, the industrial worker, second, and third, the soldier. In other words, they are now supposed to be the key group in society. They are no longer just the exploited, at least that's their theory. And so you see from a life of a man like that, drawn into this movement, and when you see behind him countless thousands of other young people who have gone into this thing with their high motives like this, well, you sense something of the appeal and strength of the movement, isn't it, that we need to realize. And the second case, the thing that happened, I forgot exactly whether it was 1938 or 1939. Anyways, it was the year that I happened to be in Chongqing. Chongqing, as you know, then was the wartime capital of China. And I flew in from Hong Kong to see what is happening in Free China then. And I found this man, Zhou Enlai, then in Chongqing. Zhou Enlai, as you know today, is the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Communist government in Beijing. Because he was still being hounded by the government then, I had great difficulty getting to him. But I've always been interested in his name, because he is a non-Christian, comes from a fairly good family, has a good Chinese education as well, European education. So man from scholarship is tops as far as China is concerned. Man who could have had a brilliant future in the ordinary sense of the term. Yet, he preferred to risk his future and his life in his communist movement in China. He was living in a little sort of dugout type of thing, hidden in a mass of rubble in that part of Chongqing that was bombed out by Japan in a war. And through devious ways, finally, we got together. And I asked him why a man with his social and family background and his educational background that he preferred to be a communist. Well, his reason was slightly different from this pastor friend of mine. He said, the relationship between East and West, that is the Orient and the Western part of the world, what we know in the Orient is imperialistic and capitalistic exploitation of the Eastern peoples by particularly European nations at first. And to any of us who have lived in the East and then go into the Western world, we are conscious of the fact that once you cross the Suez Canal, say, and we find a different attitude towards us when we are actually in Europe. They are friendly. Generally, they treat us as equals with not too much difference. Once I'm back in my own country, then you find that there, the Western people developed a type of imperialist attitude towards us. We are an inferior race, a native of the country, and so on. And right there in my hometown, Shanghai, more than once, I've had occasion to go to a Western hotel. And this happened about 1928. I walked into one of these houses to pick up an English lady who had come to Shanghai to visit, with a letter of introduction from a mutual friend in England. And because she wanted to see a Chinese play of the old type, I agreed to pick her up, take her out. And as I walked into the lobby, somebody came up from behind, grabbed hold of me by the scruff of my neck, and wanted to yank me out of the hotel. Well, I said, why? Well, this attendant said, well, you are a native. Don't you know you can't come in by the main entrance? There's a side door reserved for tradespeople and servants and people like you. So come in by that door, not the front. Well, at least I weigh 150 pounds. And when 150 pounds are not willing to be yanked out, it's possible, it's possible to yank him out, isn't it? But you see, things like that can happen in the East. And to one who has seen both sides of the situation. Now, he came back. He said, I'm going to join some movement that will wipe out that kind of thing between East and West. And today he's the Minister of Foreign Affairs of his new government. Now, that feeling that he typifies is a pretty general feeling in the Far East, I'm sorry to say. And a great deal of the venom that's behind the fighting. Even some of the cruelties that you read about today, a deal of it comes from that kind of thing which this man wanted to give his life, devote his life to change, so on. I think we need to sense some of this type of appeal behind what we generally call the communist movement. Of course, this type of thing is not strictly communist. But nevertheless, the communist is either making use of it or giving his leadership to that type of movement. We have to see or sense some of that type of appeal to people. And when a young person like that gives his life to it, with that objective in front of him, victory or defeat, I'm not going to change him. Because he has something in his life that makes him rise above mere circumstances. Because he's holding on to something, and he'll struggle for it, through defeat or victory or whatever comes in the way. We are thinking of the faith we live by. Well, if you want to see faith that lifts life above circumstances, yes, you have an actual demonstration in many of these sincere communists that we see around us in various parts of the world. Of course, they